Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here so early, and even though we're tucked all the way at the end of the conference, appreciate you being here. I'm Miriam Vega. I'm the Executive Director of the AIDS Project of the East Bay, and I'm here to talk about Latinos in the Deep South, their challenges and opportunities for stigma-free and healthy communities, and these are my collaborators as listed here. In terms of disclosures, I have no relationships, financial relationships to disclose. So Latinos in the Deep South, it's a descriptive category. The Deep South itself is a cultural, historical, and geographic sub-region. I think many of us are very familiar with how the South tends to coalesce and tend to have certain key values, and it's an area where a lot of the civil rights movements have occurred. In particular, for the Deep South, there are seven states: Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee, that are often categorized together as the Deep South. And what we noticed in 2010, the U.S. Census indicated that the states with the largest percentage growth in their Hispanic populations includes this area in the Deep South. While it's historically been mostly a black and white area, now we have seen a huge influx of individuals that are changing the characteristics of the area. So here you will see from the 2010 census, overall in the United States, Latinos are about 17% of the population. And you will note that in each of these seven states, Latinos are not yet more than 10%. However, that middle column will show you that the growth has been huge. You will see that, for instance, in the state of Tennessee, it's close to 163% change in the population of Latinos in that state. So that is a huge, huge thing for a state to grapple with in terms of a new population, new characteristics, and new services that need to be provided. Let me tell you a little bit more about the context in which Latinos grew in the Deep South. In the last few years, especially from 2008 to 2009, 2010, the U.S. went through an economic recession. And the states in the South, in particular, suffered even more so during that recession. In particular, you had Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, and Mississippi. California is a longstanding Latino population, and so is Florida. I should note, oftentimes people at my presentation note, why isn't Florida considered part of the Deep South? Well, maybe the panhandle is, but the rest of Florida is not usually considered part of the Deep South, because it does have a very different type of characteristic and cultural background. Then also in 2010, we had the first ever U.S. national HIV/AIDS strategy, and it was released just as the data was showing also that in the South, HIV incidence was increasing. Specifically, 15 of the top 20 metropolitan statistical areas for HIV incidence are located in the South. Georgia, specifically Atlanta, Jackson, some other, Memphis, are places where we've seen huge spikes in HIV incidence. Now, layer this within 2010, the Affordable Care Act was passed and upheld in 2012. And then layer this again with the fact that in the last, let's say, 4 to 5 years, you've seen different states take on what many have called anti-immigrant bills that were specifically modeled after Arizona's 2010 law that was upheld in part by the Supreme Court. So all this comes together to create what many may say is a stigmatized Latino identity in the South. When you have economic pressures, immigration discussions, along with a change in the health insurance landscape, that one should note that many Latino immigrants cannot access still health insurance under ACA. So all this layered together creates a very cumbersome or heavy environment for Latinos to live under. Okay, So in order to better understand the lives of Latinos in the South and their healthcare access, we undertook a mixed methods environmental analysis. We did a media analysis of over 150 news media clips. We also interviewed key stakeholders throughout each of the seven states. We did focus groups. We attended city council meetings, health department meetings. And we also did what's called community mapping, where we went out into the neighborhoods where there was a huge influx of Latinos, and we sat, observed, and talked to everyday folks in the environment. And we talked to them about five key areas: health, leadership, community organizing, educational attainment, and political power. We compiled all that data. Many of the interviews range from 1 to 3 hours. We transcribed them, entered them into InVivo. We translated them. We did the typical qualitative data analyses. We also analyzed the media articles that we gathered using similar methods as well. And then we developed themes. And what I'm going to present here are the themes that came from the study. So what we found is an ecological model. We found that there were three levels to the themes: at the societal, microcosm, and individual level. So in terms of society, what we found was that Latinos have a tenuously structured relationship with society. Laws, policies at the federal and state and local level impact their daily lives and impact whether they access health care or not. Immigration, health insurance laws, and local policies also impacted Latinos to the point that many felt that they were not welcomed in those areas. At the microcosm level, and what we mean by that is their immediate environment. So you have the state issues and the federal issues. We've seen at national levels right now, even right with Trump and all of these people talking about the status of Latinos. So you have that, but then you have the more immediate area in which Latinos live, where they oftentimes have a love-hate relationship with their immediate environment, and I'll get into this in a little bit more. We also see that they try to retain their cultural and community practices while also trying to assimilate, and we found that there was a huge debate amongst Latinos themselves as to whether they should be assimilating, acculturating, or some other mixed way of being. And then we also looked at Latino leadership and how it was oftentimes fractured by the very nature of the fact that Latinos are not a homogeneous group, and also by the fact that there are some long-standing Latino groups in the South as well. So while there have been a huge influx of Latinos into the South, in a place like Louisiana, you have a long-standing Honduran population that's been there since the 40s or earlier that came because of the Chiquita plantations, and they came to work that state and have really integrated into the society there. So you see these very integrated communities versus those that are very new, trying to determine how to raise their voices in unison. And at times, there was some discord there. And then we saw at the individual level their day-to-day lived experiences around work and family, and sometimes language being a barrier while they were trying to reach the American dream. And I'll get into that a little bit more as well. So let's look at the first theme here. If I'm going to point you to the picture of the driver's license from North Carolina. And this was proposed for undocumented immigrants. I don't know if you can see, but it's in pink. And then right under the word driver's license, it says no lawful status. So this is the quintessential aspect that Goffman talked about when he talked about stigma and having a marked identity. Here you have a driver's license that is truly marking someone as no lawful status. So this weighs down heavily on many of the individuals that live there, and it makes it so that they even had a very tenuous relationship with the healthcare system. In order to go to a doctor, many people have to get into a car to drive there. In the South, things are very far apart. So imagine having to go to a doctor with this type of ID. Do you feel welcomed in a healthcare setting? Do you even want to go? You probably won't go until your arm is basically falling off. And that's what we heard over and over again. Also, the state of Latino activism, because of things like this, what we found is that many people told us they didn't want to rock the boat. They wanted to stay quiet and go under the radar. They didn't want to keep getting these no lawful status IDs for their being. So I shouldn't say that all Latino activists wanted to fly under the radar. There's definitely many that are. And what you see is that you will see more Latinos, say, for instance, in North Carolina, which is interesting, this is where this was issued, because you see more Latinos that have settled there, and you have individuals that represent older generations as well. So they feel a little bit more secure, and when they feel more secure, they then feel that they can rock the boat a little bit more. I just want to go through very quickly. As you can see, these are the anti-immigrant legislations that were proposed in each of the states, and many of them died in committee or were blocked, but even if they died in committee, they were still raised at the state level, and so Latino identity was continuously being discussed. Right now, just the past 2 weeks, we had discussion in Texas about birth certificates, the state refusing to issue birth certificates to children born to undocumented immigrant mothers, which goes very counter to the very nature of our country. And then 2 weeks ago, in North Carolina, you had HB 310, where part of the Protect North Carolina Workers Act, they were trying to address the problem of illegal aliens of having a sense of belonging here. Well, I don't think many people would have a sense of belonging if they have a document that says no lawful status, but so they're still, right now, this week, much of this is being discussed. Quickly, the uninsurance rates, as you will see here, Hispanics are the, what is that, a salmon-colored bar? They represent the largest percentage of individuals uninsured. So even with ACA, you still have many Latinos not being able to access healthcare. Theme two, this quote really struck me. When we were talking to a Latina in Alabama, she said, "Alabama is a great place to live despite the racism." So there's a lot of compartmentalization that's going on. So individuals look at their immediate areas and say, well, the state may be having this, but my neighbors are okay. And so it's an okay place, even though there's a lot of racism towards me. So you see in each of these places that Latinos are being valued differently depending on the state. So a place like Tennessee actually seems to be much more welcoming towards Latinos because they do have certain large refugee centers there as well. But constantly what you see then is that Latinos live in a state of fear. They talked oftentimes about how they text each other if there's ICE raids going on two blocks over there, and they give each other routes to avoid while in the car. And also, in terms of the historical backdrop of race relations in the Deep South, what we notice is that there's a hunger for many Latinos to learn from African Americans on how to develop a civil rights movement there. And there's a hunger to try to bring these two groups together. While at the same time, Latinos felt invisible because oftentimes the backdrop is black and white. So they're trying to find a way to work together and make themselves seen more, although they don't want to be seen in terms of just being an illegal alien. Even individuals who are citizens, automatic citizens like Puerto Ricans who live in the South, they oftentimes get singled out in a restaurant, we heard, for speaking Spanish and saying, go back to your home country. And they're like, well, this is my home country. So there's this constant negotiation of identity going on. Here's a quote from someone who said, all this led to an uneasy feeling towards the economic recovery, which places Latinos in a difficult position as they are at times portrayed as taking jobs away from other disadvantaged and marginalized groups at the bottom of the economic ladder. So there's, it seems to be a fight for this economic ladder as to who's at the bottom and who's moving up. This picture here is from a very small town in Louisiana in the northern part, where this little Latin market that sells Goya products, and that was the big thing. You could see the Goya sign everywhere, and all Latinos knew to go there. We hung out there for 4 hours and talked to so many people who were coming in and out who just freely talked about what their lives were like there, and that this little place acted as home for them. And they're trying to build more and more of these places. And the owners of this place oftentimes went with individuals to their healthcare appointments to act as translators and just help them even pay for the visits as well. And then what the third one is the day-to-day lives, where many Latinos are trying to reclaim or claim that they are Latino in the Deep South. So they are Latino, they are American, and they are part of the Deep South. And they're also trying to note that there are differences between each of the groups, and they don't want to be all lumped together. So Salvadorans versus Mexicans and the Argentinians, they all have different needs, and they want to be seen as their individual groups. And many of them also talked about holding themselves accountable, that even if they have this mark, they still have to keep striving to do better. And we heard over and over again that everyone talked about the work ethic of the Latinos there, who were oftentimes working 3 or 4 jobs and sometimes had a gun pulled on them by a construction site owner saying that they weren't going to get paid that day. So, but yet still many of them felt that they had to do this in order for their kids to have a higher quality of life. So all this comes down, if you think about it, raining down on their beings and on their mental health. They're living with constant fear. There's also something that we call the Latino tax. So those individuals that are a bit more embedded in society are oftentimes called to be the translators, to be the ones that act as, you know, Superman in the community, that are called at 2 a.m. when someone's arrested. They're the ones that every single city council or health department reaches out to represent the community. So it's that too weighs down on them. And they oftentimes feel that they have this fractured identity that they're walking around with. So I like to say that they're living under this stigma umbrella. And I have to say, as a Latina also, I too have seen the Latino tax firsthand. We are oftentimes called on, even if we don't know medical jargon, we'll be called on to translate in an office and help navigate that. So overall, there were 4 key findings. Latinos are living under great fear and highly stigmatized identities on a daily basis. They're subjected to pervasive institutionalized stigma that impacts their ability to access healthcare services. And one of the ones that they really can't access is mental health, because that's considered specialty care. And so while they can maybe sometimes access primary care, they can't get specialty care. And so a lot of clinics have to beg and plead with mental health providers to provide help to these individuals, many of whom are suffering from trauma from their journeys. So access to mental health providers is a key concern. Most noted that they want to access mental health. Prevention behaviors are not a common cultural script for Latinos in the Deep South. As I mentioned, many of them may not go to the doctor unless their arm is totally falling out, because culturally prevention is not there. But also, when you think about it, if you have to get in a car and go through roadblocks, you may just say, you know what, I'm going to stay home and weather this sickness out. So in terms of recommendations, we need to enhance healthcare access and availability and the acceptability of it as well, with a particular emphasis on mental health. And we need to prioritize a response to institutionalized and felt stigma associated with the Latino identity, and also improving community policing efforts. I haven't addressed that much, but that was another major issue in the findings, the fractured relationship that Latinos have with local policing efforts. And that's my presentation. I'd like to acknowledge the Latino Commission on AIDS, Ford Foundation, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, all the interviewees and the community members that are living day to day in the South. Thank you. None of the Deep South states have expanded Medicaid, so that's problem number one. That has definitely led to a lot of individuals not being able to access care. And just in terms of HIV also in the South, it's very stigmatized. We are 33 years into the epidemic, and we're apparently on the verge, everyone keeps saying, of getting, you know, ending AIDS by 2030, yet stigma is the number one issue that prevents us probably from reaching that goal. And ACA has really been a thorn in the side for many Latinos in the South, without the expansion. Also, there's rules around you have to have been here 5 years as an immigrant in order to access certain healthcare services. So there's more and more efforts by community clinics to find ways to provide those services, and the rise of federally qualified health centers in the South as well that are helping, because many of them will provide services they should all provide services regardless of ability to pay. So the role of those community clinics will increase even more so, but that puts a burden on them as well as they see this huge influx.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I really enjoyed it. I was going to say that HB3
hoping to do more on this. I first heard of this Latino tax back when I was in Berkeley. I was warned as I was getting my doctorate that if I went into academia, I would be the Latina on all the committees, and it would impact the move towards tenure. I think many of you may have heard some of this as well. And then So that stayed in my mind. As I went into the South, we saw this over and over and over again. We had people that felt that they were doing 3 or 4 jobs in their office because they were the only one who spoke Spanish. So now they were translators. Now they were running people back and forth while also doing accounting. So, we had people who were in the finance department going into medical visits to do translations. And that weighs heavily on them. We also saw in Louisiana there was this new initiative to encourage individuals to ride bicycles throughout the city of New Orleans. And they had said, oh yeah, we need to reach more Latinos, but they put no money into translating the materials because they just figured that the people who spoke Spanish on the committee would just do it. It's a constant burden and something that they live with day to day. But I'm hoping to do more on these individuals that are living this Latino tax. No, I'd love to speak to you about that. Yes. Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. I don't know if I probably have to wrap it up, but if there were any other questions, you can take them later. Yeah.